Okay, pretty good. So let me, I was hoping to get to sorting today. I seem to still not have quite gotten my act together entirely. So I'm gonna do the randomness lecture that I had prepared last week. And I'll use it as an excuse to talk about some things that I'd like to introduce in the sorting lecture anyway. So let's see what we've got here. All right, so I already told you about voting machines. So what I'd like to do is, the way that we've talked about computers so far, and I think this is actually completely accurate, they're deterministic devices. And what that means is, whenever they're in a particular state, whenever they're set up a particular way, the next thing they do is always completely determined. There's no randomness. There's no modification in what it does. Now, you can, by typing as, you can actually make it do other things. But you know, left to its own devices, it's going to go through a sequence of steps. And if you put it back to the beginning, it's going to go through that same sequence of steps again. Which is fine, which is a really nice thing to do. In fact, it's very useful that computers are so predictable, because then when they go wrong, you can actually trace back and make it do that wrong thing over and over again until you can figure out what it is that's making it go wrong. Like, human bodies are not quite so clear cut, right? So my spouse is a doctor, and she's had to deal with the fact that, well, so, you know, this person was sick for a while, and we did some tests, and then the person stopped being sick, and so we had no idea what was going on. Now, interestingly, computers do that sometimes. There's a lot of sources of non-determinism in computers. One is that whenever you put them on the network and connect it to the rest of the world, the rest of the world can make your computer do weird things. Another one, the fact that it has input and output also makes it somewhat non-deterministic. And there can be loose bits inside the chip that make it do weird, unpredictable things. So sometimes the hardware gets flaky, and the result of that is that it starts acting in unpredictable ways. But nevertheless, by and large, the way that we think about computers is they're deterministic devices, which is great. However, it turns out that randomness, being a little bit random, can actually be very powerful for solving certain kinds of problems. So I wanted to give you what I think would be a really easy to understand example of when randomness might actually be a big win in trying to compute something. And we may encounter some others as the semester goes on, but by and large, at least you'll have some sense of, randomness can be useful. All right, so here's an example. Let's say that we've got a list of n small integers. N equals, what is that number, 10 billion? Okay, so a lot of small integers. And we want to know the average value of these integers. How can we calculate this value, and what running time do you expect? So you've got this very, 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 very long list. And each element of the list is a number. And we want to know the average of those numbers. So what would be, well, just in words, how do we compute the average of the list? Yeah, what do you think?
Add them up and divide by the number of numbers.
Add them up and divide by the number of numbers. Now, what makes you think that's all related to average? What's that?
It's
about the top. Yes. So it's sort of the definition of an average, right? The definition of an average is the sum of the numbers divided by the number of numbers. It's just what it is. So, yeah, so that's a reasonable thing to do. We'll actually apply the definition. How would we get say this list were in Python, how would we get Python to actually compute this for us? Now, we can say in words, sum up the numbers, but we have to tell it to step somehow. We have to tell it to go through and actually sum up these numbers. Do I actually have the code for this? Let's see. Yeah, okay, all right. So maybe you can't quite specify exactly what these steps are, but I'll show you on the next slide. But about how long do you think it would take? How does the time for summing up and dividing by the number of numbers grow as a function of the number of numbers, n? So is it like, oh, maybe, you know what, in fact, here's a good idea. Since I forgot to make a clicker question, that's a clicker question. Let me write the choices. So the question is, if we want the computer to actually add up the numbers and divide by the number of numbers to get the average, how long would we expect that to take as n grows? Is it like log n? Is it like n? Is it like n log n? Is it n squared? Is it like 2 to the n? And to solve this, what you want to do is you want to think about what are the steps that you would go through if you have this big long list, right? What do you do to each of the numbers in the list? How much work do you have to do on it to solve the problem? All right, so let me just solicit answers from you guys.
So there's a bound on the sides of the number?
Yeah, they're all small numbers, like, you know, 1 to 100 or something like that. Oh, I don't have my things. You're going to say the same thing, aren't you?
What?
No, what's your question?
You didn't answer
question. Yeah, so that's what I just said. I said to myself, oh, I don't have my clicker. And then you raised your hand and I said, you're going to say the same thing. Oh, I don't have my clicker. But now you have my clicker. So how long does it take to add up a list of numbers and divide by the number of numbers as a function of n, the number of numbers? And those are big O kind of things, like log linear, quadratic, exponential. That's possible. I might have to accept two different answers for this, depending on what you think I mean by time. But I think only John is going to ask me about that. I can see it coming. All right, so a couple more seconds. Say 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, stopping. All right, so okay. So here's the kind of the straightforward way to compute an average with a little bit of Python code. So we've got a list L, that's an L, it looks like it could be a bar or a 1 or an I, but it's an L. L for list. Alright, so we've got a list called L. We start off keeping a total. We initialize that total to 0. Then for all the numbers I in the list L, what we're going to do is we're going to take I, add it to the total, and store it back in the variable called total. In other words, take whatever the total was and add I into it. When this loop is finished, after it's gone through all the elements in the list, what's total? Total's going to be, it's not like 11, 10. In words, what is total representing? After we've gone through all the elements of the list, and for each element of the list, we've added it into the total, at the end of that, the total's going to be, well, the name of the variable is total. Maybe that's a hint. It's the total. It's the total. In other words, what? The
sum
of the, well, no, not the sum of the total. The sum of the numbers in the list, right? The sum of all the i's in the list, right? This is, I can't help seeing it this way, so it's possible that I'm not seeing it the way that you're seeing it. But to me, this is what it means to sum up a list of numbers. We just go through all the numbers, and for each one, we add it to the total. When we're done, the total is the total. Then we take total and divide by the length of the list, and that gives us the average. Why did I put the plus 0.0? Does anybody remember that from when we started talking about Python? Well, you know what would have gone wrong had I not done that? It would have done everything as integers, and so we wouldn't have gotten, like, the average of a bunch of numbers couldn't ever be a fraction if I don't put this in. So this way, it'll allow it to be, I don't know, like 0.33333 if that's the average. All right, so this totals up all the elements in the list. How many times does it execute this addition command? It executes it, say there's n elements in the list. How many times does it do this total equals total plus I line? How many times does it execute this total line? Does it once for each element in the list? If there's n elements in the list, so it should do it how many times?
N.
N, thank you. All right, very good. So in fact, and that's where all the work is happening here, right? It goes through, it adds all these guys up, and then this, you can, this is just one thing it does, one quick arithmetic expression. All right. So the total amount of work that this is doing is basically n. It's doing n additions. So I would say B is the answer here. But let's see. That was the C is mostly the answer. Ah, so now here's the interesting. Now you're going to take me to task. Are you ready? Can you play? Do you know? Have you any idea what I'm talking about?
Well, yeah. If the integers were bounded by some other number, then it would be log that number of times.
Ah, all right. So there's a sense in which everybody actually the majority of people got this right. So I'm not sure it was for the right reason. So somebody who gave n log n, I think there's a justifiable reason to give the answer as n log n. So I'm not trying to make anybody look like a sucker. But can anybody tell me why he or she put n log n? It's most of the group here. What were you thinking?
It looked like it made sense.
It just looked like it made sense. Now, is that pretty much where everybody was on this?
Step three.
Yeah, this is your idea. Collect what? Step three, profit. All right, so, and there's a sense in which it actually is right. So let me see if I can explain the sense in which it's right. I would look at this and say this is an order n algorithm. It's doing n work. It's doing n addition, so it's just n. However, how hard is it to do this addition? Well, how many bits is this total going to be? Let's say that the numbers are all, say, in the range 1 to 100. So they're all basically the same number of bits. After we've added up n of them, all right, this is maybe involving a little more log than you're used to. But the total can be as big as the number of numbers times whatever the bound is on the size of each number that we're adding up. So the total can be as big as n times b. Now, if b is some constant, the number of bits in b is log b. The number of bits in this answer is log of that. All right, so now here's the thing that you may or may not remember about logs. The log of a product is equal to the sum of the logs. This is why in the old days, before there were calculators, people used to have slide rules that were all in logs. And the reason for that is people knew how to add, but multiplying big numbers got kind of hard. So if you could turn multiplication into addition, you're actually making things easier for yourself. So the total number of bits in the answer is basically log n plus a constant. So toward the end, as we're adding numbers in here, this is more or less log work to add things into the total. And then doing this division on something that's log size is about log time. So I think we're doing about n log n plus log n. You can ignore that because it's smaller. So it's really kind of like n log n. That may have been what you were thinking. Perhaps not. All right. So this is how I would do an average. This is the easy way to do an average. Total up all the elements in the list, divide by the length of the list. It's basically order n. It's order n instructions, but some of those instructions might take log time. All right. But let's say that we don't actually want to compute the average. We want to know the average, cooks, maybe plus or minus 2%. Does this remind anybody of anything? On the news, you'll often hear people saying, here's the average, but we actually don't know the average, but this is within 2% of the average. Does this sound like anything that people say on the news a lot, especially, say, right before last Tuesday? No? Nothing? I got nothing? Tuesday? What happened on Tuesday? The elections. Yeah. Okay. Good. Before the elections, often people are interested in how the elections might turn out. But they can't actually do it exactly, because that would involve actually holding the election. That would be very difficult and expensive and complicated to actually get everybody's vote. So that's not what they do. What do they do instead? Looking for a word.
Poll.
Yeah, that's the word I'm looking for. Poll, right. So they take polls. What's a poll? You don't ask everybody. You ask some random set of people. Right? And then you take the answer that you get for that random set of people and say, this is probably what it's like for everybody, but unless we got really unlucky. So there's a chance that, in fact, this is not representative. So we're going to say, within 2%, we've done it right. So that's a really interesting idea from a computational perspective, I would say. So we want to estimate the mean of a population. The mean of a random sample approaches the mean of the population proportionate to the square root of the sample size. What does that mean? That means that We're trying to compute the mean of a big collection of numbers. If we just randomly sample, then the average of the sample is going to be like the average of the full set. But not exactly, but it will get closer and closer to it as we take bigger and bigger samples. And the speed at which it gets closer to it is like square root of the size. But what's interesting here is the error here, how far off we are, depends on how varied the population is, how close we want to be to the right answer, and how big a sample we take, not the size of the list. It could be 10 billion, it could be 10 trillion, it doesn't matter. If we want to get within 2%, you can get by with the same size sample. So here's what the algorithm now looks like if we're going to do it as sampling instead of actually taking the real average. We're going to start off, we'll say, let's see, our sample size is going to be 100, let's say. Now we total up some numbers, but which numbers do we total up? We're going to total m different numbers, and the way we're going to get a number is this is a Python expression that actually picks a random number between 0 and whatever you ask it to do, minus 1, I think. Actually, I think it doesn't do minus 1, so that's a bug. Anyway, the point is that we're choosing a random element of the list. That's what this says. Random. Give me a random integer between 0 and the length of the list. So give me a random position in the list. We're going to take that list element, add it to the total. We're going to do that over and over again. And then at the end, we divide by m, right? The size of the sample, not the size of the whole list. Once we do that, we get an estimate of the average. So why does this have to be random? What happens if we don't do our sample at random? What if we always say take the first 100 elements and just average those? Well, then we could get really screwed, right? So if our list consists of, say, 100 zeros followed by all the rest ones, or in this case, say, 600 zeros followed by 400 ones, then the average is actually 0.4. But if you take the first 100 of them and average those together, you're going to guess 0. And it's never going to be very accurate. What happened here? Well, I tricked it, right? I gave it a list that was in some kind of structured way. If this algorithm uses randomness, I can't trick it, right? It's going to do pick a card, any card, right? It's going to choose elements from all over the list, and on average, it will actually turn out to be the average. All right, so in this particular case, if we run average, the randomized version on the list, I ended up getting something like 0.44. When I ran the version that actually just used the first 100 elements, that gave 0, which is a really crappy answer. And the real average is 0.4. So this, my sample average is really close to the real average. So that's neat. So you can get an answer that's very close to right without having to even look at some of the elements in the list. So anyway, I find that to be a really powerful idea. So now we can actually have we can have a running time that depends not on n at all, but it's actually, we usually write big O of 1, constant, like this, big O of 1. So it's basically the same running time no matter how big the list is. That's kind of cool. That's a big difference between growing proportionally to the length of the list, or even n log n, as you suggested. This is saying, forget n altogether. It's always going to be the same amount of time no matter how big the list gets. So that's pretty slight. All right, so let me take a little aside and talk a little bit about how do we generate random bits, or how do we generate random numbers? So I'm going to take it one step at a time. Since numbers are made out of bits, we can generate a random number by generating random bits. So let's say that we've got some subroutine that whenever we call it, it gives us back a 0 or a 1, completely at random, like half the time 0, half the time 1, in an unpredictable way. So, let's see. Good, all right. So, if we can do that, if we can get a random number, either 0 or 1, whenever we ask for one, how can we use that to get a random number 0, 1, 2, or 3? Which, you know, so 0, 1 is kind of like a coin flip, right? It could be heads, could be tails, equally likely. How can we use something like a coin flip to give us something like a dreidel? Dreidel gives you a random choice between four things, or a spinner, right, if you will. Like it's got a yellow segment and what am I thinking of? I'm thinking of Twister. Is that right? Does anybody know Twister? Left hand. How many colors are in Twister?
Four.
All right. So let's see. We've got to pick a random color. 1, 2, 3, or 4. They don't sound like colors, but you know what I mean. And all we can do is generate single bits, single random bits. So how do we generate a random number, 1, 2, 3, or 4, given that only the only thing we can ask the computer for a random bit. Or let me ask it one last way. Let's say you want to play Twister, but you lost the stupid spinner. All you've got is a coin. How can you play Twister using a coin? Now, one thing you could do is you could say, well, we'll say heads is blue, tails is red. There's also, I think, green and yellow. So we're going to flip our coin. Whatever comes up heads, that'll be like blue. And whatever comes up tails, that'll be like red. And we'll just pretend the other colors don't exist anymore. That's probably not a good answer. So can you give me a better answer?
What if like heads equals blue or green and tails equals red or yellow? And then you flip twice.
You flip twice. All right, and then what do we do with the second flip?
Like the first flip, if it's heads, it's between blue or green. And then the next step, you do heads between blue and tails between green.
So we're going to flip a coin twice. The first time it's either going to be heads or tails. The second time it's either going to be heads or tails. And this table tells us what happens. If the first time it was heads and the second time tails, that would be green. If the first time was heads and the second time was tails, that would be red. Sorry, wait. The first time was tails and the second time heads, that would be red. All right? What's the probability of these three different events happening? Like what percentage? What percentage of the time is it going to come up blue? A fourth, right, a quarter, right. So in particular, each of these is equally likely. So this wouldn't be good if, say, 90% of the time it came up blue, and then 3% came up green or red or yellow, something like that. That wouldn't quite work out. We actually want it to be equally likely to be each of the different choices. So with one, With flipping two bits, each that can be 0 or 1, we can actually get equally likely over four different possibilities. So that's good. All right. So let's generalize this a little bit. What if we actually wanted to get a number 0 through 15? So now there's 16 different choices. We can do the same kind of trick. But if we just flip two coins, there's only four different possibilities that could come up. And that's not going to help us choose among 16 different possibilities. Anyone willing to admit they played Dungeons and Dragons? Is there a 16 die that comes up in that? It's like 20, 32. Is 32 one of them? No? All right. Never mind.
There's 8.
There's an 8.
So I hear.
8 is sort of from what you've read. But now we're talking about 16 choices. So we like to choose equally likely 16 different possibilities. Two coin flips is not going to do it. What else you got?
Four coin flips.
What are we going to do with four coin flips? Fine. We're going to flip a coin four times. Now what could happen? The first time it could be heads, second time heads, third time heads, fourth time heads. Sure. And it could be that we actually get all four times tails. How many different orderings of these are there?
16.
16, right, exactly. And how did you know that? You didn't count them, I'm guessing.
No, it's a multiple of, or exponent of 2.
There you go. Right, so each of the coin flips basically gives us another number in the exponent. A coin, which is a two-sided thing, flipped four times, gives you 16 different possibilities. They're just like bits now, right? This is just like 4-bit numbers. There's 16 different 4-bit numbers. Okay, so that's great. Okay, so now I will throw you a curveball. What if we actually want to get equally likely among 0 through 2? That means there's 3 different possibilities, and we want each of them to come up with 1/3 probability. Well, we could do this. We could flip the coin the first time and get either heads or tails. We can flip a coin the second time and either get heads or tails. And I don't know, what's something that's 1 out of 3? Well, anyway, we're trying to have 1, 2, or 3 with equal probability. So here's what we're going to do. We'll say if it comes up heads both times, that'll be a 1. If it comes up heads and then tails, that'll be a 2. If it comes up tails and heads, that'll be a 3. And if it comes up tails both times, that'll be a 3. So now we can have 1, 2, or 3. It worked. Why didn't it work? So half the time we're going to get a 3, but that's okay because we like 3 best. No, it's not okay. So it's not okay. So this doesn't really work. We can't just flip 2 coins and then say, okay, and the answer is 1, 2, or 3 like that. Unless we split it up differently. We can split it up like this. I don't know what the hell that means, but it looks like 1/3, 1/3, 1/3 now, right? Okay, that's not a reasonable answer. So what can we do? What do you think? Sure, I could draw it as a pi, but I don't think that. So I don't think that means anything, right? So I can draw a nice pie chart, peace sign, right? We would like to choose uniformly among these 3 things, but that doesn't tell us how we get heads and tails to do this. Now we could do heads, tails, the other thing. But I'm still cheating. I need something that would actually work. Any brainstorms? Yeah.
Any question, I lost sight of the objective.
Ah, okay, all right, so that's fine. We're trying to, we'd like our computer to generate random things for us. And let's say somebody has already taught the computer how to do essentially coin flips. Zero, it can give us a random bit, 0 or 1 with equal probability. What sort of things can we do with that? Well, we can get random bits, obviously. We can get a random number between 1, 2, 3, or 4 by using 2 bits. We can get a random number of 0 through 15 by using 4 bits. But what if we want in between things like a random number of 1, 2, or 3? And so how can we possibly do that given that the only thing we know how to generate random is 0, 1? So it's just a coin. Yes?
What if you flipped 3 times?
3 times.
And you got heads twice, that's 1. Tails twice, that's 2. And you got any combination of both heads or tails, then that would be.
All right, so let's see if I understand what you're suggesting.
You
flip a coin 3 times.
Yeah.
It can either turn out heads, like heads the first time, heads the second time, heads the third time. Or it could be heads, heads, tails. Or it could be heads, tails, heads. There's 8 possibilities. I just was writing them up here.
Wait, I don't know if that's what I was saying.
It is what you were saying. You don't know if it was right.
It might not be what you meant.
Maybe I was thinking it, but saying it, and then looking at it, it was all 3 different things.
Well then you can just choose among them. That's exactly what we need. 3 different things. So you don't want me to go finish this idea? All right. All right. All right. So here's what we can do.
I remember what I was thinking.
Ah!
I don't know if it makes any sense.
All right.
Saying flip a coin twice.
Flip a coin twice.
If it's heads and then heads.
Okay.
That's 1.
Good.
If it's heads and then tails, that's 2.
Good.
And then if it's tails and tails, that's 3.
Okay. All right.
Does that make sense?
Uh huh. So far. And what happens if it's tails then heads?
Yeah.
Aha.
How about if it's either if it's heads and tails or tails or heads, it could both be 3, or is that?
Yeah, that's I tried that, but she didn't let me get away with it.
Yeah.
Well, you just did it over. It was tails and heads.
Oh, tails and heads. Do over. Interesting. Let's think through what will happen here. So, with a quarter probability, we'll get 1. With a quarter probability, we'll get 2. With a quarter probability, we'll get 3. And with a quarter probability, we get nothing. We do a do-over. What's a do-over? We have to flip two coins again. So we flip two coins. With what's left, probability a quarter, we go here, probability a quarter. So really what's happening is inside this box, we now split it again into four, call it one, two, and three. And what happens, and here we do another do-over, right? It's an infinite do-over. One, two, and three, with a do-over inside here. One, two, and three. There, I did all infinity of them, as far as you know. What fraction of this picture is ones now? It's actually a third. It's exactly a third. It's a little hard to see that it's exactly a third because the chalk is fat, but it really is. Now we get one with probability a third, two with probability a third, and three with probability a third. And what's the probability that this goes on forever and never, ever, ever stops?
100%.
I'm not sure I remember what question I asked. What's the probability that it will go on forever and never stop? And you say 100%. But that can't be right, because a third plus a third plus a third plus 100 is like 200. Could it ever happen? Could you ever go forever never getting? So this is a weird, this is about infinitely small probabilities, which you probably haven't thought a lot about. But we say that that happens with probability zero, which is to say that it's not like it can't happen, it just can't really ever happen, which is a weird distinction. But when you're dealing with infinities, things get a little funky. But the fact of the matter is, no fraction of this picture is devoted to not stopping. You always will eventually get either a one or a two or a three. Right? Unless you got really broken coins, right, that always come up, tails, heads, tails, heads, tails, heads, tails, heads. But that wouldn't really be random. Those wouldn't be real coins. So this works. This actually gives you a third, a third, a third. And all right, so then this is something that I mentioned last time. How many times, on average, how many times are we going to have to flip our two coins before we get either a one, a two, or a three? So the probability that we get a 1, 2, or a 3 is 3 quarters. This should remind you of the how many times do you have to have a child before you get a girl on average. It's the same kind of thing. How many times do we have to flip our two coins before we get either a 1, 2, or a 3? Do you remember the trick? So if it was with the boy-girl thing, you have to have on average two kids because the probability of a girl is a half. So the number of times before that happens is 1 over p. It's 2 in this case. So it's always 1 over the probability. So if the probability of stopping this is 3 quarters, you can take 1 over that. Right? What's 1 over 3 quarters? 4/3, right? Like 1 1/3. Right? So on average, this is actually going to stop very, very quickly. In fact, most of the time, you'll get it on the first try. And on average, you'll never really need to get past the second. So that actually works. It's actually a very cool, clever trick. So, well done. All right, so good. So given our random bits, we can actually get, and this trick generalizes, right? We can do 1 in 5 if we had to do 1 in 5. So here's how we might write this in Python. If we want a random number between 0, 1, 2, or 3, what we can do is take a random bit that's either a 0 or 1, multiply it by 2, so now it's actually either 0 or 2, and add to that a random bit, which is either 0 or 1. The sum of those things is going to be 0, 1, 2, or 3, all with equal probability. We want a random number up to 0 to 15, we can do the same sort of thing. Give me a random bit, multiply it by 8. It's in the 8th position on the binary number. Give me another random bit, multiply it by 4. Give me another random bit, multiply it by 2. And give me one last random bit. Those four random bits give us a number between 0 and 15. To get a number 0, 1, 2, or 3, it's a little trickier. Here what we're doing is we choose a number 0, 1, 2, 3, or 4. No, sorry, 0, 1, 2, or 3. And whenever we get 3, we try again. So this is while we haven't gotten a valid answer yet, choose another answer. It's the same thing that we've got up on the board there. Okay. So, oh yeah, look at that. It even turned out to be the same thing. 1 1/3 calls per random number, 0, 1, 2, equally likely. So we can just, if all we needed to do is, let's see, sorry, if all we could do was generate random bits, we could use that to generate other random numbers that we might need. How do we generate random bits? Well, most computer languages have already done this for us, but just to give you a sense of how this might actually work, I forget where I dug this up. But you can actually do some pretty weird stuff. So here's a sequence of trues and falses, or random bits, that I think is pretty random looking. And the way that I generated this was by starting with some number 1,000, and I always take the, if it's odd, it's true, and if it's even, it's false. And what we're going to do is, over time, we're going to take that number, multiply it by some big screwy number, add some other screwy number to it, and we get this weird sequence of integers that flips between odd and even in a very unpredictable way. So people have studied this. There's actually some very, very clever random number generators out there. You don't really need to know how they work, but the point is that these are what's called pseudo-random. In other words, we always get the same very random-looking sequence. Did I tell you about the book on Amazon, the random number book? Have we talked about that at all? So random numbers are useful not just to computer scientists, but they're very very useful to people who do experiments, like psychologists or medical researchers. And so back in the day when not everybody had a PC, they still needed their random numbers. They were doing experiments long before we had computers helping us with this stuff. and you can see what sort of things I searched for. Ella Enchantment. I do have a 7-year-old daughter. All right, so random. Yeah, here it is. There's a book which is now out in paperback. called A Million Random Digits with 100,000 Normal Deviants. If you read the reviews of this book, they're actually very funny. People were making it. Basically, this is a book, page after page after page of random numbers. Because if you need a random number, you just flip to a random page and there's one right there for you. It's crazy, but this turned out to be really, really useful to a lot of people. Now it seems very silly, and if you actually, the reviews are written as if this was actually a book that you read cover to cover. It's like 6, 9, 3, 2, 4, 7, right? And so the reviews are very cute. But the point is that just like we can have a book of lots and lots of random numbers that we can use to make pretend that we're flipping coins, what you can do with a computer program is basically the same thing. Just by having a very complicated, difficult to track sequence, it's always the same. But whenever you tune in, it looks kind of random. Anyway, all right, I don't think I need to say much more about that. All right, so there you go. So we can actually generate things that look a lot like random numbers, and they act a lot like random numbers. So we're going to pretend they're random numbers. We call them pseudo-random numbers. If we wanted really, really random numbers, we could put like radioactive material in the computer in a little box. Because as far as physicists know, it's completely unpredictable when radioactive atoms decay. But as far as I know, no one's actually done that except for really crazy physicists. So here's what you actually got at the moment. So there's an algorithm called the Mersenne Twister by two guys from Japan from 1997. It generates random digits, and it eventually repeats because it's a computer. It can't not repeat. It is deterministic. But it repeats only after 2 to the almost 20,000 minus 1 iterations. In other words, longer than you could possibly, probably more than the number of computations which can be performed in the future existence of the universe. So there's plenty of numbers there to use for randomness. They've been proven to be equally distributed in 623 dimensions for 32-bit values, whatever that means. And it runs really fast, too. When I do random numbers in Python, I think I'm using that. So it really looks very, very random. All right, so one use of pseudo-random numbers is not just for, say, averaging lists or sorting numbers, which I'm going to talk about real soon now, but also in transmitting secret messages between people. So let me... So now we're changing gears a little bit. Now we know a little bit about how computers can pretend to be random. Here's something that people use one of the things that makes randomness randomness is that it's very unpredictable. Unpredictability is also really useful for hiding information. So this is how secret codes work in computers. So what are some of the contexts where computers try to keep secrets? One is passwords, secure web pages, right? You ever, I don't know if you've, everyone's probably been to web pages that start with HTTPS colon, that's a secure hypertext transfer protocol. It's when you're ordering on, like in Amazon there, I could have gone and if I went to order a book, it actually does this in a secure way so that people listening in, if anybody tapped into my computer wire outside my house and so forth, they would not get any information other than what looks to be completely random bits. They wouldn't really be able to see what I was doing or what my password is or what my credit card number is. So that's a useful thing to be able to have. You can also encrypt files, again, to keep people from snooping into them. There's a thing called digital signatures or authentication, which also has this property. There's lots of times when you want the computer to be able to verify that, you know, for only you can really see what's going on here. Only you can see the message. So here's, people probably know this code, but in any event, it turns out to be fairly useful in the context of the internet. This is called the Caesar rotation code. I think it might have been used by Caesar. I probably should have looked that up before telling you about it, but it's known as the Caesar rotate, also known as ROT13. Somewhat unpleasant name, but the basic idea is you're going to take a message that consists of letters in English, and each letter is going to be changed to some other letter, and this is how it's going to be done. So if my initials are ML, the M is going to get, if I Caesar rotate it, if I encode it using this, this code, the M is going to get turned into a Z, and the L is going to get turned into a Y. So encoded, my initials are Z, Y. Now what happens if I encode my encoded initials with this code?
It turns back.
Right, so if you know how to encode things this way, you can not only make messages hard to understand, turns out that it's relatively easy to make messages that are hard to understand, even better, you can turn them back into something that's easy to understand. You can turn them back into what's called plain text. Here's a little algorithm in Python just to reinforce the syntax to everybody. If we want to encode some character C, where C is, you know, 0 through 25 for the 26 letters of the alphabet, if C is not in that range, it just returns it back. Otherwise, it takes C and adds 13 to it, and if that gives you something that's not a letter anymore, we subtract 13 from it. And then we return. Oh, in that case, we return C minus 13. Otherwise, if C plus 13 is still a letter, we return C plus 13. Why does this do the right thing? Well, if you look at what's going on here, what is, for example, a letter like E, what does that get encoded as? It's the number that's 13 forward in the alphabet from it, right? So E, the letter E plus 13 more letters in the alphabet gives you R. What about 13 past R? 13 past R gives you something that's not a letter anymore. It goes off the end, past Z. But if you take R minus 13, we get back to E. So that's all this is doing, right? It adds 13 if it can, otherwise it subtracts 13. And that actually does this code. Very simple to do. So here's how ROT 13 works on a string. I guess you probably don't really want to understand this. But basically what it's doing is taking each letter that you want to encode, shifting it so that A is worth 0, encoding it using this encoding scheme, turning that back into a character, and making a string out of the whole thing. So anyway, if you take ROT 13 of my whole name, Michael Littman, you get Zifpernri Zigunzna, which you can think would be the basis of a really interesting, you know, Russian-sounding language, I think. My favorite word to do ROT 13 on is the word ravine, because when you ROT 13 this, you actually get, what's the relationship between ravine and this? It's ravine backwards. That's kind of cool. It's the longest such word. Anyway, all right, so here's a question. If I say piz triv gref at zir, what is that? That's an encoded message. Can you decode the message? Well, I don't know. P is C, B is O, Z is M. C-O-M, P, U, T, E-R-S, computers. Can anybody do, so half of you work on the last word and half of you work on the second to last word. Just get it done faster that way. And you're gonna just write 13 it. What's a
computer's bug
me? Computers bug me. Does that work? B-U-G. Yeah, yeah, computers bug me. It could have been cleverer, but there it is. All right, so what about this ROT 13? So one of the things ROT 13 gets used for a lot on the internet is if you, oh, I don't know, if you're, say you went to see a movie like The Sixth Sense. Has anybody not seen The Sixth Sense and would be upset if I gave something away? Everybody who was gonna see it saw it. It's somewhat old now. Yeah, we're good? All right, so there, anyway, I'm not gonna actually say anything. But the point is that The Sixth Sense has a really interesting, weird twist ending. And so if you're gonna write a review of this movie, you might wanna say something about that. But you don't wanna give it away to everybody by accident. People just see your message and then they see the ending and they're like, I didn't wanna read that. So what a lot of people do is they'll actually ROT 13 their postings or mails to email lists or web pages or what have you to make it so that you can't just glance at it and see what it is right away. But yeah, it's really, really easy. In fact, a lot of news readers or a lot of email readers will actually just let you, with a push of a button, ROT 13 the message so you can see what it really is. So it's hard to read, but it's very easy to decode. It's not supposed to be tricky. It's just supposed to keep you from being able to read something by accident. And in fact, any letter for letter sub, so this is really easy to crack, especially if you know it's in ROT 13, you know exactly how to decode it. But I actually can take any letter for letter substitution code and pretty much crack it if you have enough text to look at it. It doesn't even really need to be very long. So here's a concrete example. I used to love doing these. I haven't done them in a long time. So these are called cryptograms. People familiar with cryptograms? These so get printed in the newspaper sometimes. What's going on here is each letter in this message corresponds to some other letter. So all the A's here are something. We just don't know what yet. It's one other letter. All the B's are something, some other letter. In fact, you start to look at it and you say, well, wait a second, B is by itself in a word. In English, there's really only two words that are one letter, I and A. If you look at the other pattern of where the B's seem to occur, it looks like it's a little more likely to be an I than an A. So you might just guess it's an I. And then once you've done that, you notice that there's this PBS with a three-letter word, where the PV also occurs in the beginning, like there's PV something P, that's gonna be the. You just start to get a sense of this. And sometimes, I'm not always right at this, but it gives you a really educated guess and you can just start going through. If you guess that this is the, then this is TH something T. What's that?
That.
That, right? So that's that. And that's why I know that this is not A, because G is A, so B must be I. Anyway, you can just, little by little, you can just crack it more and more until you realize what the whole message actually is. In this case, it's a Dave Barry quote. I arrived at the airport 1 hour early so that, in accordance with the airline procedures, I could stand around. So these are so easy to do that people put them, they're on the edge of being easy, right? They're easy enough to do that you can just put these in newspapers and people can solve them. Certainly, if you've got really sensitive information that you want, you know, something about your business or something about your fiance or whatever it is that you've got that you want to keep secret, if you use this kind of code, you know, you're really opening yourself up to being having that message being read by somebody who's sufficiently persistent. So this kind of code is fun for newspapers, but it's not very good for actually keeping secrets. All right, so here's what I'd like to work up to is a much kind of harder code to crack. See if I can do that. And so the way I need to do that is by using a relationship between letters, English letters, and bits. And the way that I'm going to do that is assign each letter of the alphabet a 5-bit code. So A is all zeros, B is 0, 1, C is, this is 2 in binary, right? D is 3, E is 4, F is 5, and so forth, all the way up to Z is 25. And then just for yachts, this will be space, will be 26, period will be 27, question mark will be 28. Anyway, we fill it out. There's 32 different 5-bit patterns, so I've got 32 different characters that I can encode. So here's how we can put a message and put it into bits. Say we've got the message, a secret, and we want to turn our secret into bits. So we start with the A. We look on the table on the previous page. A was five zeros, so we write down five zeros. Then we had a space. Space on the other page was 11010, so we put that in. S, the next character in the message, has its own five-bit pattern. We put that in. I made every other five block of five in bold to make it a little bit easier to see this, right? So this E is 00100, as is this one. This E is 00100, right? Whenever E appears, that's the five-bit code I use. Good? All right. So since I told you the code, this isn't actually very secret, right? If I just gave you this sequence of bits, you could very easily turn it back into the letters and read it. So we're not done yet, but this turns out to be a really important step. Any message now, as long as it only uses those 32 characters, can be written as a string of bits. The number of bits is going to be 5 times whatever the number of letters is in your message. We good? All right. So now what are we going to do? Here's what we're going to do. We're going to flip some of the bits to make it harder to read. Now, if we flip them completely at random, we will lose the information in the message. So we're not going to do it completely at random, but we are going to do it. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to use XOR. Now, I've mentioned XOR before, but we didn't spend a lot of time on it, so let me remind you how this works. We're going to take each bit in the message, and we're going to XOR it to some other bit. And here's how XOR works. 0 XOR 0 stays a 0. If we XOR a 0 with a 1, it turns into a 1. If we have a 1 and we XOR it with a 0, it stays a 1. If we have a 1 and we XOR it with a 1, it turns to 0. So XOR, it means exclusive OR. It's OR, but not AND. In other words, if one is true or the other is true, but not both, then it's a 1. Okay? Another way to think about this is first bit equals 1 means flip the second bit. So if whatever the first bit is, this is symmetric. So I think I'd rather say it the other way. We have some bit of the message, like a 0 or a 1. If we XOR it with a 0, it stays the same. If we XOR it with a 1, it flips. So we're going to flip some bits depending on which ones get XORed with a 1. Now, the sequence of bits we're going to use for XORing, we're going to call that the pad. Okay? It's just some sequence of bits. Taking the XOR of that sequence of bits with our message gives us what looks like complete gobbledygook. So here we go. So let's say that I wanted to send out everybody's grades by email, and everybody can see what I send to everybody. That would be, but only one of, so I want to send out, one person's grades, but I'm going to send it out by email to everybody, but only that one person knows the secret pad. So here's the secret pad. Here's just a bunch of bits known only to that one person. Here's the message I want to send. You got an A in the class, grade A. Grade A turned into bits according to the rule that I already told you. Looks like this. Okay? So this is GRADE _ A. Okay? So this is the message. And here's just a bunch of bits, and we just agreed on it in advance. Then, if we XOR these, 0 XOR 0 is 0, 0 XOR 0 is 0, 1 XOR 1 is 0, 1 XOR 0 is 1, we're going to go through pairwise down this list. And at each position, we're going to take the XOR of the two bits at that position. And that gives us a new message. Right? It's the same length as our original message. And if we look at it as a series of characters, this grade A actually became C space Q ?? Q G U. Now this is really interesting, right? Because unlike the Dave Barry letter substitution example I gave, look what happened here. There's a repeated Q. There's two Qs that show up in the encoded message, but these Qs don't stand for the same thing. One of these Qs, G R, this is an A, D E space, and this one's a space. Now you can see why this is going to be a lot harder to crack, right? If you can't even depend on the fact that once you figure out what this letter is, it doesn't tell you anything about any of the other letters, you're not going to get anywhere. Another thing that happens is you have a repeated question mark. Repeated question mark don't correspond to repeated A. G-R-A, yeah, I don't know what that is. So if I really can tell you a pad in advance, and only one person knows that pad, this message is completely uncrackable. If you don't know what the pad is, you get no information whatsoever about what the secret message is. That's pretty slick. So how do we actually send, how can we send pads around? If I really want to send secret messages to you guys, how can I do that? The only way I can do that is if you have, we both know the secret pad. But of course, if I say to everybody, hey, here's the secret pad that I'm just telling to one person, the cat's out of the bag. Now you know exactly how to decode the message. So that's not good. So one way to do it is if we actually had our, we had the same pseudo-random number generator, and we agreed in advance on a seed. So maybe just like one number. So I write it on a piece of paper, and I slip it to you once and for all. And then from then on, you know that number. That's actually a pretty good way to do it. But that's kind of hard to demo. So here's what I'm going to do instead. I'm actually going to let you use your clicker numbers. I'm going to send a secret message to one person in the class. And you, to decode it, you need to use your clicker number. It's whatever's on the back of your clicker, which presumably only you know. So is Jessica here?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to send a message to you. All right? Mm-hmm. So the good news is I did a lot of the work for you. In fact, it's not so secret, because I'm telling everybody your clicker number. So let's just see what would happen if we'll do it with someone else in a moment. But if I were sending it to Jessica, only Jessica knows this number. Does this correspond to what's on the back of your clicker? I got it out of my list.
Yeah.
All right, good. So I have everybody else's too, but now everyone's got Jessica's, which is going to make it hard for me to send her secret messages in the future. First thing I need to do is interpret this as a pad, as a sequence of bits. So here's what I'm going to do. On the clicker numbers, 0 becomes 4 zeros, 1 becomes 3 zeros and a 1, 2 becomes 0010, 9 is 1001. You can also have an A as part of your clicker number, that's 1010, a B, that's 1011, a C, that's 1100, a D, that's 1101, E is 1110, and F is 1111. Now, Jessica doesn't have any of those letters in hers, but some of you do, I know that. So we can take this, the 0 becomes 4 zeros, the 1 becomes 0001. When all is said and done, we get a long sequence of bits. How many bits? Well, the clicker numbers are all 3, 6, 8. These are hexadecimal digits. Eight characters long. Each of those 8 is going to become 4 bits. So that's 32. All right, so each of you has a random 32-bit sequence that only you knows. All right, so now this should be enough for us to actually send a message. So let me see if I can actually pull this off with a demo. How much time do I have? A couple minutes, all right. All right, first thing I need to do is make it so you can't see what's going on my screen, because that would give away too much. So, how do I do that? Oops.
You go to the app.
Go to the what? Oh, is it up?
You were in Finder, and it showed up when you were in Finder.
Oh, darn it. So like that. Yes, thank you. Okay. Now you should just see blue. Is that right?
Yeah.
All right. All right. I'll start off with a message to Jessica if I can do it. Meanwhile, it might help if you write down your clicker number in bits. If you have a scrap piece of paper. Actually, you know what you could do is actually send me a secret message. And you can announce it to everyone, but only I will be able to understand it, because I know your clicker number. So let's step through that. Let me step through that. So we're gonna have Jessica send me a secret message, and then everyone's going to be able to do the same. Okay, so we should have her clicker number here. Here it is. All right, so there's the clicker number. Here it is in bits. Okay. Now we should be able to take a message. Uh,
hi. Because otherwise it's a big pain. All right, so here's a short message. Here it is in bits. How did I do that? If need be, I can put the table back up on the screen, but here's what I did. The message is hi. I took the H, and that's 00111, and I took the I, which should be one letter after that, 01000, okay? So that's 10 bits. Now I'm gonna take Jessica's clicker number, which you can see on the screen at the moment, put it underneath of it. So this is the pad, this is the message, all right? So the pad is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, starts off with 7 zeros. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 zeros. Then it's got 10111. 101, well, it goes on, but we only need the first 10 to transmit this message. All right, so now we're gonna XOR it. 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, okay? Interestingly, this is H again. H didn't get changed. And what is this? All right. 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, and N. So if she wanted to say hi, she sends me HN. All of you look at that and say, it's nonsense, but I use, since I know her clicker number, I can reverse this back to the original message and find out that she said hi. Okay? So, try that. Pick a, for starters, just pick a, pick one, a one or two letter message. Did everybody do it already? So you have a, you need a two letter message, then you need to write down, let's do two letters. Unless you're really good at this. Write down the two letters, and then underneath, write down the 10 bits that make those two letters. So again, if it was high, it's 00111 for the H, and then 01000 for the I. And then you need to XOR it with your clicker. So you'll need, if you have a two-letter message, you need 10 bits from your clicker, which means you have to decode the first three characters on your clicker, turn them into bits, XOR them, turn it back into letters, and then you have to tell me what your message is.
Mine didn't work.
What does didn't work mean?
At, and my first two numbers are 00.
At? Oh, you were going to send the message at.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So if we were going to do at, then...
0, 0, 0, 0.
The first letter is 5 zeros, and the second letter is 10011. Then you take the first three characters on your clicker, and you make bits out of them, according to this table. You line them up, take XORs.
Yeah, 0, 0.
What's wrong with 0, 0?
0, 0, 0, 0, 0. Yep.
What's wrong with that? Maybe that's correct.
Then it comes out.
So
at,
see, the thing is, it actually, oh, it stays as at?
Yeah.
Yeah, but nobody knows that that was the actual message.
except for me. You're saying because you're the first two digits, the first three digits, or two and a little bit, are zeros?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it doesn't end up changing. You're right. You're right. That's right. And so maybe that's not a good pad. With a hand in the back?
I was going to say it happened to me too.
Because the first couple digits of your clicker are zero? That's okay. I mean, it just doesn't end up changing anything. All right, does anybody have a message for me? Okay, then keep going. I want to get a secret message. This is supposed to be cool. Okay, you got something. Oh, but we all know you're a clicker already. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, but what number, what do I give you?
You tell me if you have a two-letter message you're sending me, tell me the encoded two letters.
The one that I got after you, like...
After, right. If you tell me the original two letters, then that would be the message that you're trying to keep
secret.
Okay,
I can see if I get it right.
Sure.
One.
Oh, wait. Oh, is that... No, it can't be one.
Can it start with a one?
It should start with a letter. I mean, if you have a two-letter message you're sending me, you should actually tell me a two-letter message that's encoded.
Oh, wait, I know what I have to do. Hold on.
You have to turn it back to letters.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, good.
I don't see why you
find
three numbers if our message is in two letters.
You need 2.5 of these, because each of these are 4 bits. You need 10 bits. You need a 10-bit pad. And each character on your clicker gives you 4 bits. So you need 4, 4, and 2.
I don't know, whatever. Why do you need a 10-bit pad?
Oh, because if you're sending me a 2-character message, each of those characters is 5 bits. So you're sending me a 10-bit message. You got it?
It should be ST.
Okay, you're going to send me a message ST. Let's see. Let me see if I can figure out what that actually is. ST. Message to... Right. Here, just take this thing. ST. And I need your clicker number again. No, because that would be giving away the secret.
Oh, yeah.
Don't read it to me. I'll just pull it off of this slide in front of everybody. SW. That's not much of a message. It stands for software. So, all right. So I got SW and you wanted SO. So if you tried to send me SO, you should have actually told me SL. Should we step through it?
Yeah.
Let's step through it. All right. So, the message is S-O. So what's S in bits? 10010. And what's O?
01110.
Okay. And your clicker number, we know, is starts off with 017. So that's 0 is 1 is 4 zeros in a row, then the 1 is 3 zeros and a 1, and the beginning of the 7 is 01. So we take the XOR and we get 100 100 1, and 1 XOR 1 is 0. 10 is a 1, 01 is 1. Alright, so that should be the bit sequence that you want.
Oh, I know what I did. I added the 0.
Carry the 1, right. XOR is a little different. So now we've got 10010, which we said was S. We can only find it again. Alright, so 10010, this is an S. And 01011 is L.
Okay.
Right. So if you told me SL, I would have said, hey, she's saying so. So
I didn't know what the character was.
Yeah, just remember the XOR is happening on the bits themselves. And it is a little bit like adding, but there's no carry.
Okay.
Does anybody else want to try this? Yeah.
AN
is your message?
Yeah.
Wait, is the secret message? Wait, is the...
No, that's the...
The public message.
Oh, it's public.
All right, so you're sending me AN. Well, in is the coded one, and what was your name again?
Mark.
Mark. I need to know that because I need to look up your clicker. Ow!
No.
Alright, we may need to practice sending our secret messages if we're ever going to get our secret decoder rings. Alright, I've got 2 minutes to try to wrap this up. Let me see where I am. Alright, so the rest of this was just really weird, wacky ideas that I just wanted to expose you to, but you don't have to really remember. One of the things that's cool is there is a notion of public key cryptography, where I actually tell everybody everything. Both basically something like the pad and something like the secret message. But what's neat is I actually, instead of sending them to you directly, I actually multiply them by each other. And since factoring numbers is hard, this turns out to be a really interesting and clever way of sending secret information. Like if you know the factors of a number and tell everybody the product, they don't actually get as much information as you might think. Some people are using quantum effects, quantum mechanics. I don't know if people have had physics and looked at this stuff. I don't know much about it. I know that Einstein didn't like it, but you know, tough noogies, it actually seems to be working out as a pretty good description of what's going on. People talk about Schrodinger's cat, which is, if you can't see it, and some quantum effect killed it, the cat is actually simultaneously alive and dead, and actually becomes either alive or dead when you look in the box to see how it's doing, which is kind of creepy. People are now talking about building quantum computers, where you actually, instead of having bits, you have qubits, quantum bits. And what quantum bits are is they can either be 0 or 1, but you can't tell until you look at them. And what's neat about this is it turns out you can actually factor numbers very quickly if you don't actually look at them. That's just how it works. There's a guy named Peter Shor who's with me at AT&T. I think he's at MIT now, who actually showed how you can actually factor if you have qubits. Factor very quickly, which means you could crack codes, which is pretty interesting. Then there's no more secrets. But you do open up some wild possibilities, like quantum cryptography, where you actually encode messages with qubits, and then you can't crack them with qubits. And so people have looked at this. This is a picture from some article someplace where they show how quantum mechanics can be used to send unbreakable codes. All right, so what I'm going to do, I'll start off next time with a little bit more about randomness. I guess you don't need to know those. But I'm going to use them in my analysis of sorting algorithm next time. So now I have no more excuses. I have to do sorting.